Good morning, everybody. My name is Larry Jacobs, and this is 3K12 Education Talk Radio on June 10th, 2020. And I thank you so much for listening in either today or on the archives. And we do know a lot of people listen on the archives. Most people listen on the archives, as a matter of fact. The nature of podcasting, which is just fine with us. And we archive every show over at education-talk radio, one word, education-talkradio.org. That's our website. And we put a new schedule up there on Saturdays. If you want to check that out, you can go any day you want. Every show we've ever done is archived over there. The last 2 weeks are right on the homepage. And then you can go to an icon called past shows or archive shows. We have everything we've done since amazingly 2011. So please feel free to go over there and enjoy it. I can't tell you how many people go over and listen to old shows. It never ceases to amaze me. We also have our Equity and Access website, and we're very proud of that, what we're doing over there. ACE-ED.org, ACE-ED.org. And that ACE-ED is an acronym for the American Consortium for Equity in Education. Get it? ACE, American Consortium for Equity. ED, and that's education, and that's a place where we want teacher and industry voice loud and clear, and a lot of it. Okay, it's the home of our official journal of the consortium, which is AC&E. You'll love the current issue, and we're putting together a new issue right now. It'll be out in a couple of weeks and up on site, but we have every issue we've ever done over there under archived issues. We have a lot of news over there, a lot of information, a lot of press releases and information from the industry important during these COVID times. We want you to join. It is free. The magazine is free. Everything we do over there is free. It's for educator and industry voice on equity, on accessibility, and it's at ace-ed.org, and I hope you take advantage of that and sign on with us. We'd love to stay in touch with you. I have a show today with my good friend Jay Littman, also from Philadelphia, and his pal Jill Akers Clayton. They both work for Fielding International, which is described as an education firm. And listen to this. It is an education firm consisting of architects, planners, educators like Jill, and interior designers, architects like Jay, okay? And their mission is to create new places for learning where students can thrive in the emerging world of the 21st century. They worked in over 50 countries, all right? They know what they're talking about. They create learning spaces, literally learning spaces. So let me say good morning, ladies, first. Jill Akers Clayton. Jill, how you doing? It's Larry.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having us this morning, Larry. We're excited to be here.
It's my pleasure. And Jill, before I get over to Jay, I must ask, I didn't realize your expertise. I saw this morning is in project-based learning. Is that one of your areas of expertise?
Yes, it
okay.
sure
and
is.
Go ahead. Speak.
Oh, I've been doing project-based learning for the last almost 25 years as an educator. And so I'm fortunate enough to get to bring that to bear with facilities and project-based design for schools and educators around the world.
I love that. I hope you know my friend John Larmer over at PBL Works. Do you know John?
I do. I worked with John Larmer and worked for PBL Works for almost 10 years. So I've had lots of opportunity to spend time with John.
This is really cool. Just a couple of days ago, what's today? Today's Wednesday, so it must have been Monday. I did a show with John, a podcast with John, all about what they're offering right now for teachers and project-based learning for all educators, okay, and the resources they have available. That's Monday. It would have been June 8th. I'll send that to you a little bit later, Jill, so you can listen, okay?
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, and I'm glad you're here. And by the way, I have to ask this since I'm talking about that. Jill also in her Twitter, this is where I'm picking this up, you have the letters IB. Is that for International Baccalaureate? What's the IB
Yes,
for?
Sir. I was an International Baccalaureate coordinator for the middle years program for many years and helped our school get a continuum authorization for PYP, MYP, and DP.
Well, you really are well-rounded, and it just proves what kind of company Fielding International is. And I could talk to you for the whole time, but unfortunately I have to bring on my friend Jay too. Good morning, Jay.
How you doing, Larry?
I'm good, buddy. How are you?
Good. Enjoying the weather.
Good. And by the way, tomorrow, I'm not going to say which one is the anniversary. June 11th is the anniversary of my bar mitzvah. And Jay, I want you to know I'm still accepting checks.
Okay, well, maybe I'll give you an Israeli defense bond instead.
Thanks. Thank you. Jay and I are from Philly. We can make these comments. Jay is a partner with Fielding International. It's an amazing firm. Jay, real quick, just give us the overview of Fielding.
Well, we've been around for more than 15, going on 20 years, actually. Mm. And we have four major studios in the United States, in Rhode Island, where I am, down in the Baltimore area, out in Minneapolis, where our kind of home office is, and out in right outside of Detroit, up in just north of Detroit. And then we recently opened an office in Singapore because we're working on the Singapore American School and a bunch of other projects out there, which kind of cements our footprint across the globe.
Well, you do have a footprint across the globe. You introduced me to that school you guys designed in that Soviet Republic of, what was it again? Help me out. Something to stand.
Oh, it's Tatarstan.
Tatarstan,
whatever.
Yeah,
it was Kazan.
Cool.
The city of Kazan.
Yeah, it was a city I never heard of. We were over there together on the web, okay? And I found that place fascinating. I always find it amazing when I find out there are these major cities where people have great lives, and all over the world, I've never even heard of the city. It's just all like Wuhan, China, I had never heard of prior to the disaster or the pandemic. It's a city of like 47 billion people. Okay, and I never heard of it. Okay, and let me just say that's actually a good segue because we're talking about the world of CDC and the pandemic and how, and you guys are into this. I really give you so much credit because I could say Fielding International is a architectural firm and a design firm, but they're far more than that. They are a learning firm, and they take design and architecture when they do schools to how children will learn in that environment. We're going to talk about what this is like in the 21st century, and I guess I'll start with Jay, and Jay, if you want to pass it to Jill, you can do that, okay? But defining education in the midst of this disaster, the COVID crisis, okay, hopefully we'll come out of this shining like roses. What's going to happen? And you and I, and I'm going to preface this, you and I had a conversation. CDC came out with guidelines that were, and again, there's a health crisis, very restrictive in terms of separation and movement of children and all that, which is not, in my opinion, healthy for education, but it might be healthy for health, and I don't know. So I'll just start it right there. We're in COVID. You guys are designing learning spaces. Schools need to change. They need to refit themselves. Jay, I'll start with you, my friend.
One thing I want to say is because when we say we're a global firm, we have this unique position of seeing what's happening all over the world because, you know, essentially every time we do a school, it's a new location that we have communications with. And we have a worldwide global network. And, of course, the amazing yet sad thing is that every single one of those places has been affected equally. And I think on April 2nd, NPR reported that at that point, and this is now this is more than 2 months ago, 185 countries had schools that were shut. And that means, you know, according to UNESCO, that's 9 out of 10 school children worldwide have been affected by this. And so it's staggering. And when I talk to all my friends overseas, no matter where they are, doesn't matter if it's China or Japan or Russia or England or Germany or Switzerland or the South America, everyone has been affected the same way, and everyone is struggling, you know, with technology, with schools shut, to somehow cope with this. And I think, you know, the real tragedy of this thing really is the kids, really is, because one of the things that people don't understand is that kids learn best when they interact with other children. The minute you take that away, it becomes much more difficult to create the social compact that you need for education, again, to grow and to thrive. And there's a psychologist, Dimitri Christakis, out of Seattle Children's Hospital.
Yeah.
And he says that there's been an explosion of this sort of mental health and social emotional development issues because, you know, we can put our kids at home. We can put them on a computer. We can give them all the technology, but they're missing the magic ingredient, which is teachers physically being there and kids that they can work with. And the thing is that we'll talk more about, you know, equity and access later on in the show. But you think about it, not every kid can have that level of technology at their fingertips. I have a niece who teaches in Norfolk, Virginia, and she said that when all this happens, schools shut. Parents don't have access to cable. They don't have laptops.
Yeah,
I was in
a
school
lot of
the
don't.
Other day that were
right.
No, they don't. I mean, I was in a school the other day where there's
they
mountains
don't.
Of laptops that were just delivered for every student in the school. But in Springfield, Massachusetts, it's shut. So I think, you know, public schools are the great leveler that create, you know, opportunity for everybody. And when you shut those down, meals, health, education, all grinds to a halt. And I'll let Jill continue because I can, as you know, go on for hours.
And that's okay. But my question is, you know, schools, yes, the physical school, and I have to say schools have shut down, okay, and teachers and administrators have been doing their best under the most bizarre circumstances. They just got handed this disaster. It wasn't well thought out,
right.
Et cetera.
What
you said a minute ago, kids learn best when they're around, let's just say, other people, when they're socializing in a classroom, no matter with who, they learn best. But there is still, and we're trying anyway, learning going on to a certain degree. So I have to give schools credit, if I may. Education hasn't shut down. They're doing the best they can, but it's not like it
they
should
are.
Be. Okay? Everybody will agree with that. Okay, there's not a single person in the world, I don't think, who wouldn't agree with that. So, and you know, it's interesting. I've been thinking about this. You know, we closed down schools for 3 months in this given school year. If I think back to any given school year when I was in school 12 million years ago, you know, if I missed 3 months of school, let's say I had surgery or something like that, my life would have gone on okay. Okay, I would have caught up. Okay, that I think what we have to do now, we did the best we could. Most schools are closing, school systems are closing down for the summer now. Okay, a few are still going, but most, and I talked to a district in Pennsylvania, so they just shut down, you know, for the summer. So okay, there was a sigh of relief from the superintendent. Let's move to the future. Okay, and Jay, what I want you to do, and again, please include Jill in this, but I want to ask you because you and I talked about this, the CDC requirements. CDC came out with a whole list of stuff, and again, they're health conscious, but it is, and it's for schools, but it's not the best environment for learning. It reminds me of when I was at Bieber Junior High School in Philadelphia, and I'll give you the year 1959. Okay, which by the way, it wasn't too good a place. Okay, tell me what for learning. So tell me, okay, what's going to happen in the future? Boom, we got through this mess. Now we have to look how we're going to deal with health and how we're going to deal with structure and the learning environment. We don't even know what that's going to be, okay, in the future. But let's assume the kids go back to school full part-time, half of them, whatever the case may be. And I'll ask Jay, but again, you can pass it to Jill, whoever, whatever you feel. Jay.
Well, I mean, we ran through the CDC stuff really carefully, and I think what happened with
I know
one
you
of
did.
Our clients, you bet, and one of our clients recently said to us, you guys need to be able to respond to parents because we're going to put you in. We're obviously designing additions to some of their schools, and it's on the learning community model. And, of course, if you read word for word what CDC is saying, it implies going back 140 years. Because if you read through their stuff carefully, you know, the whole first section is all about what is low and high risk, and then about, you know, hygiene and ventilation and water systems and disinfecting. And that's all fine. There's no problem with that. Then you get to the part where they're saying, where they start getting into education, they start wading into deep water. And, for instance, they have a section called modified layout. And it says, like, space seating and desks 6 feet apart. Okay. If you do that, Larry, you got no school, because if you put kids 6 feet apart, you've got a problem. You can't fit kids in school anymore. Instead of fitting, you know, 20 to 28 kids in a classroom that's 800 or 900 square feet, you're going to fit like less than 40% of those kids. So where do they go? And then it says turn the desks to face the same direction rather than facing each other. Do they think that it just goes in one direction? No, it goes all over the room like an aerosol bomb. And the thing that, you know, Jill and I and others in our firm talked about is, well, gee, in our schools, we have learning communities. as we talked about before. So we have these large kind of complex spaces that have all kinds of nooks and crannies and multiple size rooms. You can, in fact, isolate kids into small work groups. So, in fact, if you had to put them strictly 6 feet apart, we're doing studies of some of our schools, and you don't fit 45%, you fit 85%. So now every way, they're better, but not everybody has that. Everybody has hallways with rooms. So if you're looking at the CDC, they've effectively, with that one line, have shut down the schools for more than half the kids. And facing the desks and then putting like guards up on either side of them, I mean, you might as well put them all up in Ziploc bags, and basically
the boy in the bubble
stops. You can't do that. So our group is talking to a bunch of different epidemiologists right now, because the theory is if you put all those kids in a room with every spit guard and every kind of device to isolate them, and some kid is really sick, they're going to get everyone else sick because they're in one box. And the air ventilation, all those things don't work. So major problem on a physical level. They don't want kids in communal spaces, but they don't explain why. They are right about food service, that, you know, don't put them in the cafeteria anymore. You know, put them, have the food plated and delivered to every room. And then you could use the cafeteria or you could use the gym to create more learning spaces if you need to. But, I mean, it's going to be a struggle. So I think, you know, one epidemiologist we talked to said, listen, kids are more resistant to this than less. They actually,
of course.
There's
right.
less of a chance of a child getting COVID there than, say, you know, we're not telling people, like, you know, adults that go to bars, they not go to bars, and it's like 100 times the amount of chance you're going to get, contract an illness there. So we have to, everything we always say is balance. You have to look at what is the risk and what is the reward on these kind of things. But there's a bigger issue, too, is that they're relying, and this is where I'm going to pass the ball to Jill a little bit, is These protocols are assuming that everyone is still doing a 19th century hierarchical model where the teacher sits at the front of the room and they lecture. And in most schools, even schools with old-fashioned layouts, that doesn't happen. And so a lot of the things that we're looking at is how do we go in and train teachers in new strategies on how to teach where they can, even in a normal classroom, split the kids into separate groups so that – you know, if five kids are working over here and four kids are over here, you have less of a mass, you know, infusion of an illness if it actually happens. I'll let Jill talk more about what the difference between those things are. There you go, Jill.
Thanks, Jay. Thanks. I never have we had so much thought put into reimagining schools. This collective opportunity to really determine what we want for the future of learning means that we have to interpret these CDC guidelines in a way that gives the path of learning back to the learner, and knowing that they can take on a number of routes towards success. So if we think about our learning environments, we have to create blended learning environments. And there are quite a few school districts. It's actually a consortium of school districts in Wisconsin that are evaluating what those environments look like based on the CDC guidelines. So for example, a blended opportunity where families choose between full-time distance learning or full-time in-person learning. We do have families who are saying they don't want to send their kids back into this prescriptive environment because they feel it's unsafe, so they'd rather keep them home. And we also have families that don't have the opportunity to do that. And so there another understanding of the CDC guidelines means a blended hybrid where most elementary students, because of this need for social and learning and developmental play, where most elementary students return in person, spread throughout the entire district and utilizing all of their facilities, while secondary students remain in an complete virtual and distance learning environment.
I haven't heard that one. That's really interesting. I'm going to stop for 1 second, Jill. This is really interesting.
Sure.
I want to ask you one question. I'm going to ask you, I'm not asking this personally, I'm just asking you to put it in context. Do you have children? I do.
I have a 12-year-old and a 9-year-old.
Perfect.
So we're really in the middle of this.
You are. And by the way, mention their names so Uncle Larry can give them a shout out. Hello to, what are their names? So you can play
Annabelle and Charlotte.
Hello, pretty names, Annabelle and Charlotte. Your mom's terrific. Okay, I want to ask you this. Okay, this is the challenge. Okay, Annabelle and Charlotte, do your homework. Okay, don't eat candy before dinner. Okay, now, okay, says Uncle Larry. Now, okay, I'll tell you. I'll make it anecdotal here. I here in Maine, where I live, I've been to the post office. It's starting. It's just a little bit of snow, a little bit of ice, and they canceled school. And everybody in the post office, while we're getting our meal, all the parents are going nuts that they had to stay home from work, okay, for no reason, because it was no reason by 10 in the morning, okay? And so parents were moaning and groaning, what do we do with our kids? I have to stay home now for the day for no damn reason, okay? The problem is, and I don't know how this is going to shake out, but parents work, okay? And I assume a lot of them are going to go back. And my question is, if kids are at home, and this is why I want to swing back over to the school, if kids are at home, who's going to take care of them if parents have to go back to work? Because the schools are in loco parentis. That's where kids go during the day, except for homeschooled kids, okay, which is a very small percentage. What do you think on that, Mommy? Well, Mommy Jill?
Absolutely. And I was caught in and am caught in that same conundrum. I work all day delivering online teacher professional development. So I'm working to create online project-based learning environments and online project-based learning training for teachers. And so I'm in my office delivering workshops while my students, while my children are students, right? My own kids are students in not what we call a distance learning environment right now. I would call it, as Dr. Hillary Hughes from the University of Georgia calls it, this is crisis learning. We've turned our kids over to crisis learning. So instead of my kids getting a series of worksheets and activities and experiences in school, they're getting 6 hours of screen sheets filtered through Google Docs. And so how is that environment... How is a working parent supposed to function between their own either online or necessity of work where they have to leave and find childcare while at the same time trying to ensure that your students are getting developmental and socially appropriate interaction online? And so my choice was we chose to not follow our school district's distance learning program, and I asked my students, it's so funny, they're my own kids, I asked them what their choice is, what path of learning do they want to take. I have a 12-year-old who, she absolutely wants to be an architect, so her goal was to build and play and construct and tear apart cardboard.
Make sure she talks to Jay, he doesn't make that much money, he's not that good a professional.
Right, exactly, but my nine-year-old is very social, and so Fielding International hosted a series of talks called From Gathering to Transformation. And my nine-year-old's highlight was, how can I learn to take schools from where we are and transform them so they understand what I need? And she participated in these talks on a weekly basis to help adults understand what they need so that they could create and offer more of an ideal situation from where they are. Now, that doesn't necessarily answer the question that you're asking. How do we as working parents create environments when we don't have childcare when we're doing these hybrid models? And I don't think anyone has the answer to that yet.
Yeah. See, I think the kids are going to be going back to school for the most part. This is my own feeling. By the way, no school district has taken my advice, which is no matter what grade the child is in, just give them a diploma and we can all take the year off and figure this out. Bring in the next batch. Okay.
But that didn't work.
Yeah. Nobody,
I love
your daughter's in eighth grade, get a diploma. See you later. Okay. So you can start college
next year.
But
Texas is saying, you know what? You've missed our state standardized testing. So instead of waiting until the end of the next year, they're going to test all of their kids in December based on the previous year. So the amount of stress that they're putting on school districts and the system to conform to standardization of this prior year means we're not actually addressing the larger gap that really comes from the trauma and the disproportionate crisis that this has put on working parents.
It's brutal out there. Okay, so let me swing back. Jay, okay, you look at these CDC guidelines. Okay, we got to get – I honestly believe we got to somehow we have all these buildings, hopefully – What's your suggestion? Okay, let's forget about CDC requirements for a second. What's your suggestion for schools as they plan for next year?
Well, I think
and let me say it a different way. School buildings. Let me say instead of school buildings, learning environments. What's your thought?
Well, I think what Jill said a minute ago is there's a logistical issue that's got to be solved first because.
Yeah.
If you try to distance students, you can't fit them in all the schools in a district. So, you know, maybe from K to 7th or 8th grade, go to school. Because I can tell you, boys aren't that mature in 6th grade and barely at 7th. I wouldn't leave them at home alone. Expect anything to get done. 8th grade, things start to change. So maybe through 7th grade, all those kids are in physical school. And if you have to go into the middle schools, to solve some of that, you do. And then, you know, the middle school students, upper middle, high school, they're virtual, and then you can push through the facilities. I don't think this is going to last forever. I think we're really talking about maybe 8 to 12 months, you know, worth of this stuff once school starts again, which could be another school year, obviously, but I think it won't even be that long. But I think the bigger issue is that we have to push, and that's what we're doing. We're trying to write papers, white papers, do research right now as a firm because we are a research firm as well. And we're trying to dig into this. And we're basically saying, listen, the modified layouts thing you have is retro. It's not going to work. It's actually, as Jill said, it's going to take the crisis education that we've put on these kids. And, you know, through no fault of anybody's, it's the virus. But we're going to reintroduce them back in the school and create a crisis management, a crisis education situation right in their own school. That's insane. So how do we do this? So, you know, one way, and we can talk later about how do you solve this in the future, because we built these problems into our school systems. We don't allow wiggle room in any of our schools. We have no chance of having extra space to play with because all of the reimbursement formulas across the country will not give you extra money for one inch more than what they say is the minimum that they will give you money for. So schools don't build extra. So that being said, you have a gym, you have a cafeteria, sometimes you have an auditorium, you have three giant spaces. That's your wiggle room in the schools. You can't stick kids in hallways. It's not appropriate.
And it might almost be a cafe-gymatorium for many schools.
Yeah, a lot
say
of schools
again,
don't even
Jill.
Have any.
Say that again,
things.
Jill. Say that again.
They're called cafe-gymatoriums.
Okay.
That's right. So in New England,
are you being serious? Are you being serious?
Yeah.
They're not called.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, 100%.
Larry, they are. Larry and I went to school in Philadelphia. You got a gym, you got an auditorium with theater lights.
Exactly.
And you got a real dining hall. Not in New England. In New England, I mean, look around Maine, it's going to be the same. You get a gymatorium, or if you got a real stingy school district, you get a cafe gymatorium. The kids don't have a theater. And they don't have a working gym, and they barely have a working cafeteria. I've converted more of those over the last 20 years in New England when communities fight over the extra square footage. It's unbelievable. But now the reckoning time comes. Those school districts don't have wiggle room. Any wiggle room you do have, you can start to use. But see, teachers aren't used to the schools that we design. Right. They're not used to being able to have like groups and clumps of students doing different things where they go to the student, right? And that is something that we think, you know, the theory is less chance of mass infection if you separate the students out. One epidemiologist has said dilution is the solution, you know, where you actually pull the students out into different work groups. If a kid is in there gets ill, you know, mass infection of the entire, you know, group is not going to happen. In our learning communities, they could be spread out over 10,000 square feet, not 900 square feet, but they're in an enclosed space that the teachers can, you know, totally control, and they can walk from one end of the space to the other. and put their students off in the corners. And when you start to do that, so if you're in a normal school, you can conceivably, and some schools have connecting doors between their classrooms, you can teachers working together, another skill they don't really have in a regular traditional, you know, learning environment. Again, you have to retrain them, but you can start to move the furniture they do have into different groups. Most teachers do experiment with the standard school furniture. So we're just saying break the hierarchical model, rearrange students in different learning groups, maybe even multi-age sometimes, and break down the 28 students in one room syndrome. I mean, you might have one room and you might have 18 in that room, but in different groups, a circle in one area, you know, a whole like pillowed area in another spot, cave spaces that you build up in another spot. You might be able to put a few students out in hallways that have larger spaces, but with the cafeteria open and hopefully at least the one gym open, you can start to rearrange those rooms. It means A, you have to buy furniture because there's not going to be enough furniture to do this move. And two, you have to change the way teachers think about how they're working with their students and whether multiple teachers can work with different students. And I don't know, Joe, do you want to talk more about those things? I mean, there's a lot you can do with the schools we have. So you have to, you have to think through the problem, you know?
In Beijing right now, we've been talking about what it means for flow and traffic. And in our school, other schools in China, you know, we're required to do daily temperature checks. There are mandatory face masks for students for learners above the age of 2. How do we do hand washing stations and mats that clean shoes? How in these very traditional buildings do we have one-way traffic in corridors, as well as limit to classrooms no more than 15? So really changing the mindset instead of returning to school with how we used to do things, how can we create schools based on project content? So students who are moving in and around spaces are moving in small groups based on the collaborative and individual and reflective work that they need to do. And so part of that is how do we truly change a campus mindset to create virus-free school environments? And that within a matter of 2 months, you know, where districts and superintendents are in these very political and politically tight spaces to be able to reemerge into the physical learning spaces where they have to have completely new strategies around safety, but it's also the opportunity to drop this really industrial revolution mode of education where we force students into seats where teachers are teaching. And it's our chance to really adopt more student-centered setups and shake up the decolonization or decluttering of one classroom being the only entity space for learning. And so how do we change that 20% and 30% of that day to not be around one physical space? How do we start to truly utilize corridors and movement around projects so that it's more critical? The learning is more critical, so the reorganization of furniture is more about more than rearranging furniture. It's really rearranging the different ideas of how students move through zones of learning that allows them to brainstorm, allows them to do research and gather information in smaller groups rather than within that larger group. And our communities and learning communities, our schools have the opportunity, and that's built into their learning environment, as well as our air conditioning systems and air return systems.
Yeah, well, I'm going to talk about that. I do want to talk about that. Thanks, Joe. That was good. I really appreciate it. Wait, don't say anything. We got about 8 minutes left, and if we continue the discussion, we can schedule another show next week. Okay, so I'm not worried about that. We can just continue the discussion because it's a great discussion. I love having you guys on. So don't worry about that. So don't feel pressure on that side. Okay, but Jay, Jill just brought up something that struck me, and I know this for a fact, and I'm just going to use them as an example. I know there are schools in Boston public schools that the bathrooms aren't working very well. Okay, the water fountains don't work well. The toilets don't work well. The sinks don't work well. And instead of having four sinks, maybe there's just one, okay, the working sink in the bathroom. And my question is, and Jay and Jill, you can do this too, but let me ask Jay. Jay, what the hell are we supposed to do with that? That's a safety concern in a pandemic. What do we do? Okay, and you're good at this, Jay. Infrastructure, school, not learning infrastructure, but the literal plumbing and electrical and air infrastructure. Jay, Mr.
Well,
Rostek.
Well, in Boston, there's the big M word, which is money. They don't have money. They're not being neglectful. They don't have money.
Okay, so I'll change it to Philadelphia, or I'll change it to Detroit, or I'll change it to whatever.
Anywhere,
okay?
Anywhere
doesn't
in the country.
Matter.
It's
anywhere.
The same problem.
Yeah, yeah. School budgets are being slashed all over the country as a way for communities to say adults.
No, but
so how do we bring them back in an unsafe environment that was dirty before?
Well, we can't bring them back. Well, some of those, I have to be frank, some of those school districts probably don't have the ability to open. Someone's got to set standards and say this school is going to be inspected by whoever. Could be SBA for Massachusetts. It could be, you know, RIDE in Rhode Island. It could be SED in New York State. They have to go into these schools and they have to say, you're not opening unless this checklist is done. And then someone at the state level has to say, we'll give you extra money to get these things fixed. You have to change your tax structure. Something has to happen. But it says, you know, you're going to have make other plans. You can't open up a school unless all the sinks work. Everything's in working order. You can clean the school. You know, your bigger problem, of course, is that if you follow the new CDC or EPA Energy Star standards for ventilation, no school in the country
meets
those standards.
Yeah.
Except one's built in the next last 5 years. This is a huge problem. So, you know, but in terms of what do we do tomorrow, the best you can do is the state should get every facility director of every school and have a huge consortium meeting with these guys and say, here is a list. We want you to come report back to us at the end of the week. You walk through yourself and look at every school in your district. And, you know, if it's a 22 school district, they'll have staff to do it with them. But they should just say, you are going to be responsible as the facilities department to tell us what is the actual real condition. Most schools have something called the BCS, a building condition survey. They already know where the big problems are. And even in affluent school districts right now, you know, if we're fixing up classrooms, we're also fixing the toilets and the ventilation system and putting air conditioning into every place now. But the school districts that don't have, and that is like Philadelphia, frankly, and Boston, they need to have almost like shock troops go in and at least, you know what? The other thing I would do, and it's going to be unpopular, what holds schools back is the way they have to procure services. Like if you want to get a plumber, you got to put it out to bid. You got to spend $30,000 doing drawings. And heck with that. They need to say, look, this is a super emergency. We're going to go out to the local five local plumbers to come in and fix this stuff. We're just going to suspend all this stuff and get in and fix it for the best dollars we possibly can because this is emergency. So you have to suspend all the purchasing rules, BOCES in New York State, you know, the standard purchasing contracts in Boston. And, you know, I got to say, one school district in Rhode Island, I worked with a facility director there all the way back in like 2007. And they had the flexibility because they had a huge staff in their operations department to go in and some of the first Pathfinder products we did where we changed everything, we did for $180,000. It would have cost them $2 million to do it if they went out to bid because they only had a short window in the summer. And they said, we can do this. I know how to plumb. He knows how to do
electrical. Yeah, they can do it.
We have licenses. Do it. And that's what we have to do now. We have to suspend summer rules and get creative fast.
And I have to say something else. This is key for these urban districts, and I just want to make this point. African Americans are suffering from this pandemic far out of proportion to the rest of the population. And a lot of these urban school districts, I should say Latinos as well, okay? A lot of the urban school districts, the big ones like the ones we mentioned, you can go right down the list, okay? They don't have the money. And they kicked the can, I use this phrase a lot, down the road for too long. There's been too much neglect for too long. I have five sinks, only one works. Well, we'll just leave it at that, and we just don't have the money to do it.
Okay. Well, the fact of the matter is, look where we are now with this. And this is going to be a real problem, I'll tell you, because especially in the urban districts, these kids are really at risk. And so are parents and grandparents, the extended family, when the kids go home. Okay. So God only knows what's going to happen with all this. And we have to take the time now. And again, this is the good news, if there is any good news we can pull out of all this. Okay. Is that it's an opportunity to stop, look, take a breath, see what we can do. Like you said, 180,000 versus 2 million. We have got to do this. You can't bring kids back to an unclean environment. It's that simple.
No.
Guys, we got to go in a minute. Do you want to continue this? Like, we can set up a show for next week if you want.
Absolutely. Because I think the EPA announced in April that it's offering grant funding to support healthy school environments. And I have to say, the EPA should not be offering grants. The EPA should say every school in America, based on what we need for equity in urban as well as very rural environments, experience the same equity deficits. We have to look at all of this and not announce grant funding, but how do we announce just basic, warm, safe, and dry for healthy school environments across the board to really start to address these equity issues?
It's really something. We are going to focus. Let's focus on that a little bit more. As you know, that's important to me, this equity thing, next time. I'm so frustrated with all this, but it's we got to do something, and it's just brutal out there. And we got to go on this show. I'm going to schedule you guys in. I'll send you an email either next week or early the week after. Okay, and we'll continue this discussion. Okay, how the learning environment, equity, and access into COVID. Okay, you're terrific. Jill, where are you, by the way? Where are you located?
I am located in Texas, just outside of San Antonio.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool. I was watching, I guess maybe it was PBS NewsHour. No, it was 60 Minutes. San Antonio was on last week. I hope everything's better down there.
Everything is doing okay, but we're really struggling through how to reopen and really support healthy school environments.
Yeah, it's real. And by the way, everybody's concerned. I don't blame them about the restaurateurs, okay? And there was a big thing, and food, okay? It was just incredibly important, in 60 Minutes. But nobody's yet done that big show on education coming up. I'm sure they will. Okay, and get the thoughts out there on 60 Minutes. We got to get it on there and everybody else. Incredible. We're going to continue it here, though. I'll get back to you guys right after the show. Okay. So thank you. Jay and Jill went up a hill to fix the schools of America. How's that?
Yay! Jill, love that. That's our goal. So I'll learn and thrive. But,
and we did not.
Whatever.
Fall down.
Jay and Jill. The Jay and Jill show. Okay. All right. Well, I'll be back to you a little bit later. Thank you both. Go on with your normal lives. Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is our normal.
Great. So I didn't mean to cut you off, Jay. Okay. That's funny. Okay. This is their normal life. He's exactly right. Fielding International, everybody. They got some good stuff on the website. Check it out. Fielding International. All right. It's a learning environment. Okay. So they really know their stuff. And we'll do another show with them coming up. I'll put it up on the schedule as soon as I can schedule it with them. We're going to archive this show at education-talkradio.org, tweeted out at EduTalkRadio. Please go over to ace-ed.org. That's ACE-ED.org, our equity consortium. We're going to focus on that in learning environments next time I do a show with these two wonderful people, which will probably be in 10 days or so. Because I just looked at my schedule and I noted it was rather full. Okay. My name is Larry Jacobs. Please check it all out. Sign up for our consortium for equity. We need your voice out there, ace-ed.org. It's all free. Okay, and I thank you so much for listening. And Jay and Jill from Fielding International, thank you. Everybody have a good, safe day.